From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, by the time we go to the ballot box in November, $6 billion will have been spent on political campaigns in America.
These will be the most expensive elections in U.S. history.
Two cover stories today. The first, how money may shape the election in ways you might not expect. Also, we'll ask the question, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Also, actor Jon Favreau on the movie he's seen a million times, how one musician came to dominate the funeral industry, and author Michael Chabon on his new book and his discomfort with fame.
There's a deep, important, crucial part of me that just says, you're still a loser.
Later, 3 Minute Fiction is back. Our writing contest has a new challenge, a new judge, and a new prize. Plus, Dave Matthews joins us for a performance and a chat about the band's new record.
I can remember saying, I can't imagine that I'm going to be doing this when I'm 45. And I'm 45.
Also, remember this. Western town, a dead end world. Whatever happened to the Pet Shop Boys? They'll join us. That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. There's a new stimulus plan underway in America as we speak. $5.8 billion being injected into the U.S. economy, particularly in states like Ohio and Virginia and Colorado and Florida. You might have guessed that I'm talking about campaign spending. Our cover story today, is the money game having any effect so far? This year's elections will be the most expensive in U.S. history. And as I said, by the time we all head to the voting booth on November 6th, nearly $6 billion will have been spent on campaigns, big and small, all across America. And much of that money will come from super PACs and other outside groups free to spend as much as they want. Here is how some of that money is being spent.
3 months of unemployment over 8%, President Obama insists.
The private sector is doing fine.
Romney and Bain Capital shut this place down. They shut down entire livelihoods.
Obama is trying to force gay marriage on this country.
Romney and Ryan. If they win, the middle class loses.
Now, pro-Republican groups are way ahead of pro-Democratic ones in raising that money. But that could change in the coming month. Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago and former White House chief of staff, has now joined Priorities USA. That's a pro-Obama super PAC. In a few moments, we'll speak with Bill Burton, the head of that super PAC, but first to Jane Mayer, a reporter with The New Yorker. In a recent issue, she wrote about President Obama's Achilles heel, his aversion to cultivating wealthy donors. And it goes back to right after Mr. Obama was elected.
During the inauguration, there were already grumbles from big donors who were complaining about the kinds of seats they got. They were separated instead of being put together, and they didn't like that. And then there was an absolute firestorm of upset that took place after the first holiday parties that the Obama administration had, when, unlike past administrations, President Obama didn't pose with big donors to have their pictures taken. And they felt slighted and offended, and that they weren't getting kind of the personal treatment that they were accustomed to.
You quoted some of these donors on the record and some who did not want you to use their names. But it seemed, Jane, that in some of these examples, there was almost a sense of entitlement. Like some of these folks were saying, hey, you know, I gave X amount of thousands of dollars, and I should be able to have a dinner with the president.
Well, I have to agree. I think there's a certain spoiled-sounding tone to some of it. And, you know, in fact, there's a reason for that, which is that I think some big donors really were kind of spoiled by the Clinton years, when President Clinton, he just absolutely coddled the big donors. You remember, he was accused of allowing them to come sleep over in the Lincoln bedroom. And so many of the big Democratic donors go back to the Clinton years, and they remember what it was like to be sort of friends and family. And Obama's just not like that. These are not his best friends, and he just doesn't do business the same way.
How did Barack Obama become such a successful politician and at the same time have such antipathy toward the most important thing a politician has to be able to do to win, which is to raise money and ask for money?
Well, I'm not sure I would say antipathy. I think he's very torn about all of this. He's uncomfortable with it. He doesn't want to be corrupted by it. But he's also been a pragmatist. I mean, Obama is someone who, don't forget, in 2008, became the first presidential candidate since the Watergate rules to not take public financing and to completely privately finance his presidential bid. So he's not always been a perfect angel on this subject either, but he's tried to do it on the basis of small donations and medium-sized donations, not by cozying up to the super, super rich. And he's been able to do that because of the unusual career he's had. He rose so fast to national prominence that he never really had to cultivate a donor network.
But if the president is not able to raise the amount of money or his super PACs, the pro-Obama super PACs, from these very wealthy potential donors, how much of an impact could it really have ultimately?
It depends how badly outspent he is. I mean, basically, he doesn't need to match them dollar for dollar, according to a number of experts that I interviewed, but he needs to be competitive. The question is whether his message gets through. This is a story unfolding. We're all watching it, kind of holding our breath to see how much power the money really, how much of a punch it really packs. And we really won't know till Election Day.
That's Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can find her article in the August 27th issue of The New Yorker. Jane, thanks.
Thank you so much.
The biggest pro-Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future, is closing in on $100 million raised. By contrast, the pro-Obama super PAC, Priorities USA, has brought in about a third that amount. Now, that could change in the coming weeks as Rahm Emanuel begins to help Priorities USA. He's one of the best Democratic fundraisers. Still, according to Bill Burton, the group's founder, Democrats should be worried.
This is a very close election, and the electorate is very deeply divided. And if you look at every one of the swing states, from Ohio to Colorado to Florida to Virginia to wherever, the race is basically tied, or 1 or 2 points in either direction. So with the hundreds of millions of dollars that the Republicans are going to bring to bear, plus the very difficult political environment for Democrats, even though Mitt Romney may not seem like that impressive a candidate to most Democrats, he still is a real threat to President Obama.
Why are Democrats losing the money race? I mean, you created this super PAC in part to confront the amount of money that Republicans are raising and have raised. Why has it been more difficult for you?
Republicans of means are more motivated to engage in this race. If you're somebody who is at an oil company or on Wall Street and you really want oil companies and Wall Street to be deregulated, then giving $10 or $20 million is a very small investment compared to what you're going to get back if a President Romney, deregulates your industry and, cuts taxes for the wealthy to a tremendous extent. So I just think that, Republicans see this as an investment.
Rahm Emanuel, he has now joined your group. How much money do you think he can raise for you?
I will say. I think that this is all hands-on-deck moment for Democrats.
The president, as you know, supports a constitutional amendment that would effectively overturn Citizens United, right, and limit money in politics. This is something you would support? I mean, something that essentially would put you out of business. Would you back that?
Absolutely. No, I don't think that super PACs are a good idea. I think the campaign finance system is broken and deeply in need of repair. But that doesn't mean that, as Democrats, we should sit on the sidelines while Karl Rove and the Koch brothers spend hundreds of millions of dollars to advance a right-wing agenda. To paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you go to Election Day with the rules that you have, not the rules you wish you had.
$35 million so far. What do you hope to raise by Election Day?
As much as we can. We're clearing out the change in our couch. We're checking all our pants pockets. We're putting together every single dime to make sure that our efforts are well-funded.
And you hope that you won't have to do this again?
No. Like I said, this is not the way democracy should work, and campaign finance reform is an important thing. The only way there will be reform is if President Obama is reelected.
That's Bill Burton, co-founder of the pro-Obama super PAC, Priorities USA. Bill, thanks.
Thank you.
But how much of an impact could that outside money have, at least on the presidential level? So far, it doesn't appear like it's having much at all. But according to Sheila Krumholz with the Center for Responsive Politics, that money could have an impact in a different way.
I think the money will be very targeted. It already has been in certain primaries, and we'll see that again in the swing states and in specific places. The political operatives that are running these outside groups are looking very strategically at the map and seeing where they can tip the scales in favor of their candidates. I'd say another really important impact is the dynamism that this injects into the system, that we will not know when the money will drop, where, and where it's coming from in many cases.
Why does it matter, though?
Oh, because we want our policy to be based on, and our elections to be based on, the merits of the candidates or of the bill and not on the money. So those who are ponying up the money for the election are going to be coming back. I mean, particularly for those who are corporations, trade associations, unions, this is not an altruistic process. They are not in it to promote democracy. They have an agenda, and particularly for corporations, they have a fiduciary duty to return a profit to their shareholders. So the problem is we may not know who stands to gain and what they will get in the end.
How much big money do you estimate is undisclosed on both sides?
Well, in the last election, the first one after Citizens United, we saw that $2 out of $3 were spent by organizations that were hiding their donors. So in this case, we anticipate that hundreds of millions of dollars will be spent by the outside groups, and perhaps much more than that, perhaps $1 billion or $1.5 billion all told will be spent. It's hard to know precisely because of the hidden money, the hidden donors, and also the hidden spending.
A lot of attention is being paid to money spent at the presidential level, but I wonder if this outside money is going to have a bigger impact on the congressional and state level.
I do think that that's where it really stands to fine-tune the turnout and the electoral outcomes. And again, in key states where those party operatives that have been in this game for a long time are, you know, micro-targeting their message to specific voters in specific states where they see the best opportunity to pick up a seat and potentially turn the tide in favor of their party.
What could members of Congress or the president, to people who oppose Citizens United and the amount of money in politics, what could they actually do to change it if they wanted to?
At a minimum, they can and should pass a narrowly tailored Disclose Act that ensures disclosure of the donors to these very political nonprofits.
That's Sheila Krumholz, the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics. That's a group that keeps an eye on money, politics, and influence in Washington. Sheila, thanks.
Thank you.
By the way, money doesn't always determine the victor. Bob Dole outraised Bill Clinton in 1996, but at the congressional level, it usually does. In 2004, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, House candidates who outraised their opponents won 98% of the time. Stay with us. More politics coming up, and later, Michael Chabon on his new novel, Telegraph Avenue.
This president can tell us it was someone else's fault. This president can tell us that the next 4 years he'll get it right. But this president cannot tell us that you're better off today than when he took office.
It's a simple and effective question deployed most notably by Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls. You'll stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Now, it worked for Reagan. Most Americans, of course, said no, they weren't. This time around, the answer might be a little more complicated. So to help us, I'm joined by Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research here in Washington. Dean, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us is Douglas Holtz-Aiken, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. He also served as an economic advisor to the McCain presidential campaign in 2008. Doug, welcome to the program to you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Dean Baker, let's start with you. This question, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? You actually have recently argued that this is the wrong question to ask.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of a bizarre question. I mean, let's keep in mind the economy was in a free fall at that point. I mean, we're losing 700,000 jobs a month. We had President Bush talking about how we're facing the second Great Depression. His Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, was saying the same thing, as was Ben Bernanke. So what exactly are we trying to compare to? The economy was in a free fall. We're not now. We're better off that way. Were we better off than before the free fall? Well, probably not.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, in January, February of 2009, the unemployment rate was 7.8%. Now it is 8.1%. You would argue we're worse off now.
I think the reason people ask the question is that, correctly or otherwise, presidents get credit and blame for what happens on their watch. And this is a way to ask the question, are we happy with the economic stewardship of this administration? I, for one, would say we can do better than we have. The sustained high unemployment, the fall in the median income of Americans by $4,000. There's a litany of things where we are today is not what it could have been.
The president, of course, has argued that you can't measure his record starting in January, February of 2009. But as Douglas Holtz-Eakin has argued, presidents are accountable for the economies that they oversee. So why can't we start at that point?
Well, again, I was making this January-February point. Our survey for the unemployment rate is done January 12th. Well, President Obama wasn't sitting in office till January 21st, so maybe we should take February 12th. Again, I'm not being serious with that. I'm just pointing out how silly that is, and I think the question, and I'd hope Doug would agree with me, is what would you have done better? It's kind of silly to say, okay, the house was on fire, you sprayed all the water on it. Are we better off now that the fire's out than before the fire got started? Well, probably not.
Douglas?
I think it's important, in defense of the president, not a position I'm usually in, but he acted because we had to act. The real issue is, when does he switch from emergency firefighting to actually doing things to have sustained growth in the economy? And in my view, he never made that switch, and that's the flaw.
Well, what should he have done, as Dean Baker asked?
Well, I think he should have stopped thinking that we have a stimulus problem where, the economy's falling, you have to do something. Then you have to focus on economic growth. You don't go do a health care law. $500 billion in new taxes sets up $1 trillion in new spending. You don't sit on trade agreements when they could have been implemented quite quickly. You don't unleash the EPA on a regulatory jihad in the interests of other policy objectives. A strategy change was necessary, and it never happened.
Dean Baker, why didn't that strategy change happen?
Well, I don't think we needed that strategy change. I think the big problem was we had a collapse of a housing bubble. That destroyed somewhere between $1.2 to $1.5 trillion in annual demand. That's annual. Now, we had a stimulus that's billed to $700 or $800 billion. That was over a 2 to 3 year period. In fact, some of that's still being spent out today will be spent out over this decade. In terms of annual demand, 2009, 2010, that was about $300 billion. $300 billion is not enough to replace $1.2 to $1.5 trillion in demand. That's basic arithmetic. And the points Doug's talking about, I don't think you're going to find a lot of businesses who could tell you with a straight face. They would have been hiring workers. They would have been investing left and right, but they're worried come 2014 they might have to pay a fine or pay health care for their workers. But I would say President Obama had to pull teeth to get that stimulus bill through. We need 60 votes in the Senate. We know that now. That wasn't always the case. You need 60 votes. He had to whittle away much of that stimulus in order to get anything through Congress. And some of what he whittled away was support for public programs that would have created more jobs.
He had 60 votes in the Senate. He had 60 votes in the Senate in 2009. He had it right up to the 2010 election. That's how they did the Dodd-Frank. I mean, the Affordable Care Act went through, and it was only the Scott Brown special election that changed that dynamic. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for the view that he had to work with Republicans because, in fact, the majority of the time we have mixed government. And so it's not fair for, I think, the defenders of the president to uniformly blame Republicans. It's the president's job to work with the Congress.
Douglas Holtz-Eakin, let me ask you, what about this argument that the Obama administration has been making that there's no way they could have accomplished what they wanted to in 3.5 years, that they are in the middle of this process?
Well, I see the constraints as being political. I mean, we got out of the Great Depression by spending a ton of money. World War II was our stimulus program. If we had spent the same amount of money building up roads, building up the infrastructure for the country, we could have gotten out of the Great Depression in 1931 rather than 1941. I would say the same thing was true today. Now, could President Obama have gotten that politically? Could have gone to Congress and go, here's my $2 trillion stimulus program and gotten that through? Probably not. But I think there are things that, at least in principle, could have been done to get the unemployment rate down to a more reasonable level by this day, but they simply weren't possible politically.
So with the time we have left, what's the best case you would make for the reelection of Barack Obama?
Well, I think the question is, where are we going to be going forward? And as best I could tell, I think Mitt Romney is basically saying, let's do more tax cuts and deregulation, and somehow it's going to work this time. With President Obama, I think the idea is he's going to try to have more spending in the public sector, more spending on infrastructure, education, and that's going to have short-term and long-term benefits. I think that's the best path.
Douglas Holtz-Eakin, the best case for putting a new face in the White House?
Certainly, I don't think the president is allowed to say, I should have been elected for 8 years. These are 4-year terms. Have an agenda that fits in 4 years. And the notion that somehow tax cuts and deregulation were at the roots of the financial crisis is just wrong. The Financial Crisis Commission, on which I sat, never fingered tax cuts, even though we didn't agree on a lot of things. Uniformly, that wasn't the problem. And the deregulation of the Bush administration was Sarbanes-Oxley, which is one of the most regulatory bills in history.
Came out of the Enron scandal.
So that's just a misrepresentation of what went on. Governor Romney is promising to focus on growth, that's important, and to undertake a comprehensive tax and entitlement reform which would control the debt, which is a big threat to growth. I think there's no question about that. I think that's the right strategy because it has long-run benefits and short-run impacts. And it's the strategy I would have thought President Obama would have pivoted to years ago.
That's Douglas Holtz-Aiken, former director of the Congressional Budget Office and an aide to the McCain presidential campaign. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research here in Washington. Dean, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
On this program, we've been asking filmmakers, actors, writers, directors about the movies that they could watch over and over again, including this one from the star and writer of Swingers and the director of the Iron Man series.
I'm Jon Favreau. I'm a writer and a director and an actor. And the movie that I've seen a million times is Mean Streets, directed by Martin Scorsese, starring Harvey Keitel and Robert De Niro. I first saw Mean Streets when I was young. It must have been a revival house down in Greenwich Village. I think my dad took me down there. My dad grew up in the Italian community in the Bronx and had a lot of affection for Scorsese's work and passed that love along to me. As a young boy, being able to see a R-rated violent movie with language in it was exciting, but what I didn't realize as I was younger was I was watching a master filmmaker.
Hey! Giovanino. How are you? All right, how are you?
Mean Streets is set in Little Italy in New York in the 70s. It follows Harvey Keitel's character, who's the nephew, I believe, of a mid-level mob figure in Little Italy.
Un insulto a Mario è un insulto a te.
What are you talking about? Non hai capito.
He's doing some small-time work for the boss and is looking out for Johnny Boy, who's played by De Niro, who's a bit of a screw-up.
Why didn't you make your payment last Tuesday?
What do you mean? I made my payment last Tuesday. What are you talking about?
You paid him last week?
Yeah, I paid him last week. Well, what did he say? He said I didn't pay him?
You paid him?
Yeah, I paid him. Last Tuesday?
Yeah.
Was it last Tuesday?
Yeah, that's the Tuesday that was last week. That's before the one that's about to come up.
The thing I really love about the film is just the real moments, the human interaction, the humanity of the characters. The struggle of Harvey Keitel as he's looking for some sort of context for his Catholic upbringing and the horrible realities of the street.
Okay, I just come out of confession, right?
Right.
And the priest gives me the usual penance, right? 10 Hail Marys, 10 Our Fathers, 10 whatever. Now, you know that next week I'm going to come back and he's going to just give me another 10 Hail Marys and another 10 Our Fathers. And those things, they don't mean anything to me. They're just words.
It's interesting to watch the Catholic upbringing and experience being applied to the real world. And the whole movie opens up with a quote by, it's actually Martin Scorsese's voice saying,
"You don't make up for your sins in the church. You do it in the streets.
You do it in the streets. You do it at home.
The rest is bullshit and you know it."
And that's the whole context for the film, is like, how do you not just survive day to day in a world that seems, you know, very Hobbesian? The dialogue, when everything hits the fan and you know that Johnny Boy has gone beyond the point that he's going to be able to be saved by Harvey Keitel, he delivers this great monologue where he finally confronts the loan shark that he's been dodging.
"You make me laugh, you know that? You know, I borrow money all over this neighborhood, left and right, from everybody, and I never paid them back, so I can't borrow no money from nobody no more, right? So who does that leave me to borrow money from but you? I borrow money from you because you're the only jerk around here that I can borrow money from without paying back, right?"
It's insulting enough that he has, I think, a $10 bill and he refuses to give it to him, but he sets it on fire in front of him. You know, so it's hilarious, but it's scary, and it's also really sad at the same time. And then it culminates in this really visceral, awful, unexplained resolution, which is him getting shot. It's a great way to see Scorsese's toolbox, because he's such a flashy director without ever drawing attention to himself as the filmmaker. You're always seeing it subjectively through the eyes of the characters. You sometimes forget you're watching a film. You don't really marvel at the spectacle of the film. You're experiencing it emotionally, and I think that takes a tremendous amount of restraint, and I try to emulate that.
That's actor and director Jon Favreau talking about the movie he could watch a million times, Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets. Favreau's next project will be directing the film adaptation of the Broadway hit Jersey Boys. Now to a story about music in unexpected places. Musician David Young is a New Age artist who records the sort of atmospheric music you'd hear in spas or doctor's offices. This is actually his music. We're hearing it now. And there's one other place David Young's work is heard.
So there was this lady who for like 6 months was calling my office, and she only wanted to talk to me. And so finally, after 6 months, she called on a day when I happened to be there, you know, and she was all excited. She says, well, you know, the reason why I've been calling is because I want to make sure I have the proper licensing to use one of your songs at a funeral. I said, well, what song is it? She said, it's Amazing Grace. And I said, well, sure, I mean, you can use it, and, you know, if you want, you can fax over something and I'll sign it. I said, when is the funeral? And she says, well, I'm not really sure. I said, well, do you know who the funeral is for? And she says, yeah, it's for my funeral. And I said, well, ma'am, it's going to cost you. No, I joked. I'm just kidding. I didn't say that.
So how did this all happen? Our producer, Brent Bachman, picks up the story from here.
It started back when David Young, who says he sold a million CDs over his 25-year career, met a guy named Craig Caldwell.
Hello. So, yes, I'm just going to run outside of it so I can take the call, okay?
I caught up with Caldwell in the UK.
There's actually a conference over here, Funeral Service and Bombers, and so we're here for the conference for the next 3 days.
Caldwell is the vice president of business development for the Dodge Company. It's one of the largest funeral supply companies in the world. And 6 years ago, at a convention in Chicago, he heard David Young's music for the first time.
We came across a small stand selling a lot of New Age type of products, and they were playing some of David's music. And it just seemed able to lend itself to funeral services. It really has a softness to it that makes somebody remember a particular time and point that they shared with the person that's passed away.
So Craig Caldwell got in touch with David Young.
And he wanted to make my music available for the funeral homes that, you know, they were selling all products to.
So whenever Craig Caldwell sold caskets or embalming chemicals to funeral home directors, he pitched them on David Young's music as well. Soon, Young was attending funeral show conventions, selling his music alongside more typical vendors.
Oh, gosh, like embalming tools and caskets. There were caskets everywhere. Things that you really don't ever want to have to look at all, you know.
A few years ago, writer Nicole Pasulka noticed an ad for David Young's music in a funeral trade magazine. The tagline?
Set the right tone for your funeral, yeah.
Pasulka wrote about David Young for an online magazine called The Morning News. And it struck her that many of David Young's songs were interpretations of popular songs that a funeral audience might know, like Scarborough Fair.
Cante per Tiro is another one that David does.
But put through a kind of filter.
Softened, even. Like, even more reassuring, less complex. But I think what he's selling is this filter.
And he's still selling it. David Young says sales fluctuate, but funeral directors provide a nice supplement to the business he normally does with spas and doctor's offices.
I think that the reason why they want to have music in a funeral home is because the silence lets our mind be free to run around with whatever thoughts that we have. And if somebody's in a funeral home, they're very likely to be having very sad thoughts.
But is David Young selling music or muzak? And is one necessarily better than the other? Again, Nicole Pasulka.
There's that quote, "Muzak fills the deadly silence," you know? I think there's a thing about it being quiet, and we don't even notice it anymore. It's just not supposed to be quiet. And in a funeral home, if silence does equal death, then silence is the last thing that we want.
You know, because people ask, what is it like playing at a funeral convention? And I'll just say, you know, it was a really dead show.
Our story on David Young was reported by our producer, Brent Bachman. Coming up, Michael Chabon and the Pet Shop Boys. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon is now widely considered one of the best contemporary American novelists, and each time he releases a new novel, it becomes a kind of literary event. It's no different this time with his book Telegraph Avenue that comes out this week. His publisher has set up a record shop on Telegraph Avenue, and it's a replica of Brooklyn Records, the shop at the heart of the book. The novel tells a story of two couples, Nat and Aviva, who are white and Jewish, and Archie and Gwen, who are African-American. The two men are friends and co-owners of that record store that straddles the Berkeley-Oakland border, and Aviva and Gwen work together as midwives. The plot follows these and other characters and touches on issues of race, sexuality, and redemption. And Chabon says the way he came up with the idea was by first just imagining the world these characters inhabit.
In this case, the world was a very tiny one. The initial seed was planted when, sometime in the late 90s, I, having just moved to Berkeley, I walked into a used record store, and I was struck immediately on walking into this place, first, you know, overwhelmed by the incredibly nostalgic, powerful odor of moldering records. And then I looked around, and what I saw was two guys were working in the store this day. One was a black guy, one was a white guy. And their customers were all standing around hanging out, and they were black guys and white guys too. And just at that moment, I was caught with a sense of both of longing and of remembrance, because I grew up in the 1960s and 70s in a place not far from where you are right now, Guy,
in
a
Washington,
town called
D.C.
Columbia, Maryland. Mm. And Columbia was a planned community that was built in the 1960s and was intended to be a place where people of different races could live together, could find affordable housing, and young families could grow up together. And when I grew up there, it did a pretty good job of hewing to those ideals. And, you know, I moved many times after I left Columbia, and I encountered a lot of stark realities living in other parts of the country that made me realize what a sort of, in a sense, almost like a brigadoon, you know, like a little sheltered oasis Columbia had been. And when I walked into the record store, I just got a sense of return. And that was where it eventually emerged in the form of this book.
A lot has already been written about the music in this book. There's a lot of references to old school jazz and R&B, almost like there's kind of a film score or soundtrack behind or sort of embedded within the pages. How did you think about integrating music into the prose?
Well, I listen to a lot of music. I mean, I listen to music while I'm writing anyway. I haven't always listened to music, but as soon as it became possible to conveniently and easily take music with me onto airplanes, I began to listen to music while I worked. And what I discovered very quickly was that it was possible for me to program the music I listened to. To help get me into the proper frame of mind. So when listening to this book, when writing this book, I listened to lots and lots of music. And as I went along the journey with Nat and Archie to try to kind of figure out what kind of music it was that they were most passionate about, that they specialized in their vinyl record store, that they played in the band together, I discovered this subgenre or style of jazz, which became something that a lot of people call soul jazz and then transformed into something some people call jazz funk. What it really is jazz with the backbeat restored to a place of prominence so that you could dance to it. I guess the more saturated I got in it, you know, the more it worked its way into the book.
I know I've asked you about this in the past when you've been on the program, but your writing routine, because it's fairly rigid. You've talked about how you write sort of every day, Sunday to Thursday, 10 to 3 each day. But I was
10 p.m. to 3 o'clock in the morning.
Which is unbelievable. But I'm wondering how you actually constructed the sentences in this book. Because, I mean, I can open up any random page here and find something that just seems like it couldn't have been written quickly. Or did they come out quickly?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, sentences are the purest, simplest, most pleasurable part of writing for me. And it's the part that comes the easiest to me. It is frequently the case that I, as I'm sitting and writing, I am hearing first this sort of advance. Ghosts come after, so I can't think of whatever the opposite of a ghost would be, the harbinger of the sentence kind of begins to occur to me in a sort of empty rhythmic form that has no real meaning yet, but just is a series of pulsing future syllables and clauses that are structured with a certain kind of rhythm to them. And, you know, instantaneously afterwards, the sense of the sentence fills in that empty vessel. And I'm just struggling to kind of keep up with it and get it down. But there are plenty of other times where I'm just really working and working and working and working and trying to, I trample on that initial beautiful mystical sentence that emerged, and I kind of step on it, and then it gets broken, and I can't remember how it went back together again, and I have to try to keep fixing it and tinkering with it. And, you know, I love that aspect of it, the shaping of sentences, the crafting of sentences. That's the fun part of writing for me.
I'm speaking with the novelist Michael Chabon. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. When you read, and maybe you don't, but I'm assuming that you must have come across at some point, somewhere where a critic has written, Michael Chabon, one of the greatest living American writers.
And I hate it when they say that.
And you've been on this program a few times, and I've met you, and you are a pretty regular guy, and I mean that in the most positive terms. I mean,
Thank you.
You do grocery shopping in Berkeley, but what do you? How do you feel when you read that stuff? I mean, you grew up in Columbia, Maryland, and a single mom, and here you are. Many, many critics believe that, and many readers believe you are among a handful of the greatest living writers in America.
You know, the truth is, the part of me that's walking around grocery shopping and stepping in dog poop that somebody forgot to pick up, and, you know, having to rush to get my kid at school, that part of me is so predominant, and I struggle so hard to sort of wrestle away from that side of my life to make space for the part of me that is just all about writing those sentences, that I don't know, there's not a whole lot left to spare. So I've always had a pretty powerful sense of who I am and what I want to do, and I know I can write, and I've known that since I was 10 years old, and I don't really think about it very much. I just do it. But all that being said, I have such incredible lingering after effects. Even at the age of 49, I'm going to be 50 next May, I still smart deep down inside every day from having felt like a doofus and a nerd and a geek, having been picked on and teased and everything from the time I was 10 years old to the time I was about 14 years old. The effects of that period have never gone away. You know, when I hear people giving me the kind of praise that you're talking about, as much as it's, you know, it's very nice and everything, but there's a deep, important, crucial part of me that just says, you know, it just washes over, and that part of me
that
says...
That you can't be that.
You're still a loser, though. You're still a loser.
This book is out. It has been pretty well reviewed. A few sort of lukewarm reviews, but by and large... they've been pretty amazing. Does that mean anything to you? Do you breathe a sigh of relief? I mean,
yes.
You do.
Yes. I mean, where there are certain crucial reviewers, all I feel on receiving a favorable notice is a profound, immediate, you know, almost like bladder-releasing sense of relief.
Even and though you've won the Pulitzer Prize, even though you've been...
It's not an act of pleasure by any means. I mean, it's a pleasure, but it's that kind of absence of a negative pleasure. It's just like, oh, thank God, I got past that one this time. It's about exhaling. You know, I can still remember almost verbatim negative criticisms that I got for my first book, Mysteries of Pittsburgh, in 1988, and I could not tell you for a second the corresponding words of praise that I might have received at the same time.
But reading what you've read so far, you can now breathe a sigh of relief.
A little bit. I'm exhaling just a little bit, but you never know.
That's author Michael Chabon. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. He spoke to us from Youth Radio in Oakland. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you again, Guy.
And if you want to read or download audio from Telegraph Avenue, go to our website where it's part of our new First Read series. It's at nprbooks.org. It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. That is not an egg timer. That is a sound that those of you who are regular listeners to this program will be familiar with. Of course, the ticking and the bell that can only signify one thing. 3 Minute Fiction is back. It's round 9 of 3 Minute Fiction. We have a new judge, a new challenge, and a new prize. Now, if you're not familiar with our writing contest, it's pretty simple. We are looking for original short fiction that can be read in about 3 minutes, so no more than 600 words. And each round, we've been asking a well-known novelist to come up with a writing challenge. And I'm happy to introduce the judge of round 9. It's writer Brad Meltzer. He's the author of 7 novels, including the bestseller The Inner Circle. Brad, thank you so much for coming on board for 3 Minute Fiction. Welcome to round 9.
Thank you, Guy.
As we do, Brad, with every judge, we asked you to come up with a challenge for this round. So if you will, please reveal it.
Sure. The challenge is simple. All stories must revolve around a U.S. president who can be fictional or real.
A U.S. president who can be fictional or real. Doesn't have to be Barack Obama, doesn't have to be Bill Clinton or George W. Bush.
To me, that's the best part, right? It's the president you make up in your head. That's the best president of all.
Which, in fact, is something you do, something that you've done in your novels. You've written about presidents and national security, and of course, they are made up.
Yeah, you know, when I write my novels, I've interviewed Secret Service agents and staff and first ladies and even the body person who carries around Clearasil for the president. But there is nothing like meeting the president of the United States. Now, someone once told me, anytime you even see the president, you have a story to tell for the rest of your life. You have every detail, all of time slows down, and so these stories take on a brand new importance. And that's why I love them. The hardest part of writing them is that when you write about the president, it always immediately the cliches come easy. So, you know, yes, Mr. President, no, Mr. President, the key is always finding the real person inside.
And who knew the president used Clearasil?
Yeah, no, you wouldn't believe what's in that bag. Huh. I mean, it's like Felix the Cat.
Well, Listex, okay, but Clearasil, huh?
Depends on the president.
It depends on the president.
One president, McKinley, used to carry a carnation, and he used to wear it in his lapel, and anytime he would see a supporter, he would take it out of his lapel and say, "This is for you." And the supporter would go crazy and love the fact that they got this gift from the president of the United States. And then McKinley would go right back to his office and open up his desk where he'd have 5,000 more carnations right there.
Hmm.
And it was just his daily trick, and I just love that.
So, Brad, in these stories, give me a sense of what, you know, what you might be looking for. You've got 600 words. It's not a lot of space to work with. But, you know, we have had, and I know you know this, we've had over 8 rounds, we've had 45,000 people submit stories to us for 3 Minute Fiction. And we've had unbelievable, amazing stories. The last round was just a heartbreaking story. Our judge was Luis Alberto Urrea. What are you looking for in that short space?
You know, I think it would be silly to say anything but this, which is I'm looking for a good story. That's it. To me, stories aren't what did happen. They're what could happen. They take us to places and they imagine worlds. So yes, character and setting are all vital, but only if they tell that good story. That, to me, is the most vital part of all.
All right. Let's recap. This is round 9 of 3 Minute Fiction. It is now open. We'll be accepting submissions until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, September 23rd. We have to be able to read your stories aloud in about 3 minutes, so no more than 600 words. Brad, remind our listeners what the challenge is this round.
Your story must revolve around a U.S. president who can be fictional or real.
All right, a U.S. president who can be fictional or real. There's just one entry allowed per person. If you want to send in your story, go to our website. That's npr.org/3MinuteFiction. And 3 Minute Fiction is all spelled out with no spaces. Each and every story will be read by our staff with help from students at the University of Michigan, the University of Wisconsin, Cornell, and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And, of course, Brad Meltzer will be reading some of the stories as well. And as with previous rounds, we're going to post some of our favorites on the website each week as we start to narrow it down. And the winning story will be read on the air in its entirety. The winner will get a couple of signed copies of Brad's books and also join Brad and I on the program. And this round, Brad, are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
The winning story is also going to be published in the December issue of the Paris Review. We're talking about one of the most acclaimed literary magazines in the world. So if you win, your story is going to be published, let me say that again, in the Paris Review. We're talking about a huge deal for a budding writer, right, Brad?
This is a piece of gold you're putting in people's laps. When I published my first novel, I got 24 rejection letters on it. There were only 20 publishers at the time, and I got 24 rejection letters, which means some people were writing me twice to make sure I got the point. And so if you would have given me the Paris Review, I would have taken them. That book still, just to be clear, sits on my shelf, published by Kinko's. So, yeah, I may enter as well.
All right. Any final words of writing wisdom for our listeners, Brad?
You know, I think here's the real answer. Write what you love. Even in the diabolical box that we've put you in, don't write for us. Don't write for me. Write for you. Write what you love, and I promise you it will show on the page.
That's the novelist Brad Meltzer. His newest book, The Fifth Assassin, will come out in January. He is the judge for this round, round 9 of our 3-Minute Fiction Contest, and he joined us from the studios at Classical South Florida in Fort Lauderdale. Brad, thank you so much. We're going to be checking back in with you over the next few weeks.
Can't wait. Thanks, Guy.
Once again, if you want to submit your story, check out our website. That's npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. 3-Minute Fiction is all spelled out, no spaces, and good luck. And it's time now for music. For many people, this is a sound that defines the mid-1990s. It's music by the Dave Matthews Band. Back when he founded the group, Dave Matthews was a bartender in the college town of Charlottesville, Virginia. Today, the Dave Matthews Band is one of the biggest live acts anywhere, and they've sold millions of records. Their new one is called Away from the World. Dave Matthews sat down with me recently to talk about the new record and play a few songs for us. He made the 3-hour drive to Washington from his home in Charlottesville. No entourage, no drama. Just Dave, his technician, a guitar, and a ukulele. And the first thing he told me was about the album title, Away from the World. It comes from a line in one of the tracks. It's called The Riff.
Sitting in a box away from the world out there.
It kind of is suggesting that all of us are sort of removed from the world in a way, you know, in our minds or however. And so we're all in the same boat, even though we're sort of locked in our own heads.
Take me out, shake off the dust, shake off the fear. Please don't leave me, baby. Please don't leave me yet.
What is this record about? What stories are you telling?
Maybe it covers the same sort of area as always. A lot of romance. I don't know whether it's love or sexuality, that sort of intimacy. But then also there's things that are in my mind, you know, the state of the world. And so you think about where we're going. I have children now, so I think about it more. And there's a bit of that.
You have your ukulele with you and a guitar with you, and it'd be foolish not to just shut up and let all of us hear you play the first song, which is called Sweet. This is from your new record. Before you play, can you tell us something about it?
I was in a hotel in Chicago with my family, and all my kids were getting ready. And my youngest child, who's 5, was learning how to swim, and they said, are you coming? I was also in my swimming gear. I just thought, I'll be right there, because I've been playing with this ukulele and thinking about this melody, and I had an idea. And so I sat down and wrote this song, in a way inspired by teaching my son how to swim.
The song is called Sweet, and here's Dave Matthews performing it.
Try swim, keep your head up, and kick your legs, never. If I could, I'd turn it around. Let me out, wanna get out now. You know the feeling when you're in too deep, and then you make it out the taste so sweet, sweet, sweet. I'm too high, I wanna come down, and I'm too old to wanna be. If I could, I'd turn it around. Let me out, I wanna get out now.
cover me till I'm gone. Cover me, cover me, cover me till I'm gone. Cover me, cover me, cover me till I'm gone, gone. Well, if I could, I'd turn it around. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know the feeling.
That's Dave Matthews in NPR's Performance Studio 4A with a song from his new record, Away from the World. That track was called Sweet. It was just lovely. It's such a visual song. And when I first heard it, it reminded me of being in the pools with my kids and keeping your head up and kicking in the water. That's a really beautiful song.
Thank you. It's kind of straightforward. It doesn't leave too much to be interpreted, but then it does as well in a funny way.
I want to ask you about you. You were born and partially raised in South Africa during the apartheid years. And I wonder how that has influenced the way you see the world now.
I feel very grateful for all the time I had in South Africa. I credit my mother a great deal for, and my father, but he died when I was very young, for instilling, even if being a white South African, I enjoyed the better things that that country gave to a small percentage of its population. But still having a mother that was so devoted to making sure that we knew that to be credited or discredited for something that you were born with, that you had the inability to change, whether it's the color of your skin or, you know, anything about you, was just the worst kind of crime. And I think the friends that I made and the people that inspired me from all different walks of life, it made me feel in my heart, not outside. I didn't take risks like, you know, standing in front of tanks or anything.
You refused to serve in the military.
I left the country for that. But I did feel great about the fact that, and it inspired me, was that I made, you know, the guys who worked at my uncle's dairy, I'd sneak over there and drink with them and play music, and more than play, I'd listen to these guys play music. But that felt almost like a revolutionary act. And then at the same time, I got all the gift from it. I'm really grateful for my time there, because I think when I'm back in America, it makes me not believe that nationalism is a really good idea. It makes me think we're obligated to question our government, whether we're for it or against it, all the time.
On this record, you have several songs that touch on this issue of change, this theme of change, including a track called Gaucho.
We gotta do much more than believe if we really wanna change things. We gotta do much more than believe if we wanna see the world change.
You haven't lost hope. You still think that it's possible to change the world.
I don't think that good can win. I don't think everything's going to get peachy ever. But I think we have to fight for what we believe in. I also get very disheartened by the shallowness of the debates we have. Nothing's black or white, and nothing's us or them. But then there are magical, beautiful things in the world, and there's incredible acts of kindness and bravery, and in the most unlikely places, and it gives you hope.
We gotta do much more than believe if we wanna see the world change.
Where do you see Dave Matthews Band going? I mean, can you imagine the band continuing for a long, long time, decades, doing what you do until you kind of just get tired?
I can remember saying, I can't imagine that I'm going to be doing this when I'm 45. And I'm 45.
You're 45 now.
And so I don't know if there's a place, you know, that we need to go to, but it's also a sort of an interesting challenge to try and work with the same group of people, because there's a uniqueness to it of trying to get past all the things that relationships have.
And you worked with many of these guys for more than 20 years.
Yeah, the same guys, the surviving members. There's four of us, and it's interesting that our love for each other really is revolves around the music we make together. We're not in the same age group. We didn't come up in the same places, but we really do have a unique sort of love affair when we're playing music together. And it gets stranger and stranger, but it's good.
So, I mean, as long as it works, it works.
Yeah, and there's something about those moments of bliss. My dad always said, find your bliss, or at least my mom tells me that's what he said, and then pursue it. But the moments of bliss that sort of make it hard to walk away from, I guess it's maybe in a way it's akin to an addiction, but it is really when things happen, when the joy is so big, it's like being a kid, you know, that laughter and that spontaneity, that's hunger-inducing.
That's Dave Matthews. He's the front man, of course, for the Dave Matthews Band. Their new record is called Away from the World. And now here in NPR's Performance Studio 4A, the song Mercy.
Don't give up, I know you can see all the world and the mess that we're making. Can't give up and hope God will intercede. Oh, come on back. Imagine that we could get it together. Stand up for what we need to be. 'Cause crying won't save or feed a hungry child. Can't lay down and hope for a miracle to change things. So lift up your eyes, lift up your heart, singing, mercy, will we overcome this? Oh, one by one, could we turn it around? Maybe carry on just a little bit longer, and I'll try to give you what you need. Me and you and you and you only wanna be free, yeah, yeah. But you see, all the world is just as we've made it. And until we want a new world, I got to say that love is not a whisper or a weakness. No, love is strong, and we got to get together. Yeah, gotta get, and we gotta get till there is no reason to fight. Mercy, will we overcome this? Oh, one by one, could we turn it around? Maybe carry on just a little bit longer, 'cause I wanna give you what you need. Will we overcome this? Or have we come too far to turn it around? Do we ask too much to be a little bit stronger? And I wanna give you what you need. Mercy, what will become of us? Oh, one by one, could we turn it around? Maybe carry on just a little bit longer, and I'll try to give you what you need.
Yeah. In 1986, this song, West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys, went right to the top of the charts. For the past 25 years, the London-based synth-pop duo have done one thing better than almost any other duo in Britain. The Pet Shop Boys have managed to sell records, a lot of them, 50 million worldwide since Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe founded the group in the early 80s. They're about to release their latest studio album, Elysium, and this is the first single. It's called Winner. You're a winner. When I spoke with Neil Tennant recently, he told me that when he and his bandmate, Chris Lowe, started writing songs for this record, they had a realization.
It became clear after a while that we were writing songs about being pop stars at our age, which is in our 50s, and pop music is in theory, or used to be, a young people's musical form. It's been a long time coming, we've been in the running for so long, but now we're on our way. I think the main thing is whether people still think the song sounds fresh. I think the funny thing about pop music is it goes through a phase of being dated, and then it sort of comes out of that and sounds fresh again. So, for instance, in the 90s, everyone used to despise 80s music because they thought it sounded really dated. And then suddenly, in the last 10 or 15 years, it sounds really, really fresh. And also more interesting, because 80s records have some unusual lyrics and experimental music compared with some pop music nowadays.
I want to stick with this theme of your early stuff, because there's a song actually called Your Early Stuff on this record. You've been around, but you don't look too rough,
and I still quite like some of your early stuff. This song came about because I travel around London in a taxi, I don't have a car. And London taxi drivers can be very talkative. They'll ask me questions about the Pet Shop Boys if they recognise me. And sometimes they're very, very flattering. Sometimes they're quite rude. Those old videos look pretty funny. Or they just assume that maybe I've retired now. What's in it for you now? Need the money? And I would say to them, do you listen to music? And they say, no, I listen to talk radio, which is what taxi drivers tend to have on. And also, there's always a thing in music. People will say, oh, yeah, I really like your early stuff, which is normally regarded as the kind of the pure. Hey, what's your name? Whereas we were talking about this to someone else the other day, we often like people's later stuff. Like, Chris is a fan of Elvis Presley's later stuff. You've been around, but you don't look too rough,
and I still quite like some of your early stuff. On that topic, I mean, on this idea of your early stuff, and you get asked about it. I mean, you recently, you guys played the closing ceremonies of the Olympics, which was great. It was amazing to see all those performers and you guys and George Michael on stage. But you did perform probably one of your, if not your biggest hit, West End Girls. That was the number one track in this country. That song, I've read you refer to it as the first number one rap record in the U.S. Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand that's pointing at your head. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we wrote the song, it was meant to be a rap record. It was influenced by Grandmaster Flash, but I said it in an English accent. If it had been an American accent or a rap accent, you'd have realised it was a rap record and the verses are rap. When, why, what, how much have you got? Have you got it, you get it? If so, how often? Which do you choose, a hard or soft option? But it's interesting, no one ever mentions the rap record. Yeah, you think about it. Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand pointing at your head. You think you're mad. I mean, it was an early 80s rap rhythm.
When you started out, your music was, and to some extent still is, hugely important in the gay community. And at the time, at that time, when gay culture was still not yet mainstream, it was even more significant. Did you guys consciously seek that out, that place in gay culture? Too many shadows
whispering. Well, I've always had a very ambivalent relationship with the idea of gay culture. For instance, we were briefly on Atlantic Records in the mid-90s, and all the marketing was done by the gay marketing department. And I sort of resent the idea that being gay means you like a certain kind of music, which maybe that includes Pet Shop Boys. But now I think we are, in Britain at any rate, and I think in the large parts of America, in a more open society, where people's sexuality doesn't have to determine all every aspect of their life.
What do you make of this notion that pop music, electronic dance, and hip-hop have kind of begun to merge? That you turn on the radio and you will hear elements of all of these things in a Katy Perry song, or a Kanye West song, or a Rihanna song.
No, I think what happened was that P. Diddy went to Ibiza one summer and suddenly it became a thing for hip-hop stars and rap stars to work with Euro music, house music. So Snoop Doggy Dogg can be performing with David Guetta, which 20 years ago would have been completely unthinkable, wouldn't it? That's my vision for the future. Part of our own future, anyway. But we never make plans, you know. We only ever work on the on what we're doing and think about the next thing. We don't look ahead very far. In pop music, it's foolish to look ahead very far.
That's Neil Tennant. He and Chris Lowe are the Pet Shop Boys. Their new record, Elysium, is out this week. You can hear more music from the record at nprmusic.org. Week ending September 9th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, the show was directed by Brent Bachman and Kenya Young. Our production staff includes Lauren Silverman, Phil Harrell, Lily Percy, Brenda Salinas, and Amy Held, with help this week from Sarah Ventry and Becky Sullivan. Bethony Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for listening.
Still find some hope to